This show is brought to you by MTN. For your everyday moves, try this new MTN app. MTN, SA's best network.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is the Tech Central Show, which is brought to you, quite coincidentally today, by MTN Business. I say coincidentally because I'm at MTN HQ in Fairland in Johannesburg for a conversation with Ralph Mopita, MTN Group President and CEO. And this is going to be a wide-ranging discussion on everything from the state of the local telecommunications market to the group's connected home strategy and the impact of AI on MTN's business. Ralph, thank you for making the time. It's great to see you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Always good to see you.
So we've just come out of a bunch of results, actually. You and your competitors all reporting in the last few weeks, I think a mixture of half-year results and and quarterly updates. And there seem to be some interesting dynamics going on in the South African market at the moment. At a press conference a couple of months ago, I think it was actually just a few weeks ago now, you mentioned that that the prepaid market in South Africa has become particularly competitive this year. What's happening in the local market, your home market? Are the operators getting more competitive? Is everyone behaving rationally in this market at the moment?
Yeah, look, I mean, South Africa, as you say, is our home, so we always want to be strong in our home market. And I mean, let me start by kind of framing the market in totality and then coming to the prepaid section. I think when we look at the market in terms of the postpaid market, consumer postpaid, I think what we're seeing there is, you know, from an MTN SA point of view, we're seeing good growth there. We think we're picking up a little bit of market share there. We can always do better. But in that market, I think the competitive intensity, it's more, you know, MTN versus Vodacom. That's how we experience it. When you move to the enterprise market, again, we've had multiple quarters of actually growing, you know, quite strongly. Enterprise is an area we started focusing on in about 2019, 2020, and we've seen sequential quarters of double-digit service revenue growth pretty much since that time. So we've actually upscaled and grown quite nicely on the enterprise side. In the last 2 to 3 years, I think we've seen quite a lot of competitive intensity in the prepaid market. And I think, you know, Telkom has been, you know, very kind of vibrant, let's call it that, in the market, and actually has focused quite a lot. And we feel that they have, you know, pulled back somewhat out of kind of the postpaid market. But also you've got the MVNOs, and also you've got the likes of Capitec Connect. So that prepaid market is actually quite competitively intense. And I think part of that, you see it in the results, our results, and I think you saw the guys in Midrand, you know, feeling a bit of pressure in terms of growing the top line, because we also, you know, chasing the same wallet of the customer, and that customer is also spending a bit more money on online gambling.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, there's like 75 billion that's kind of going in that direction, but that's coming from the wallet. So the real intensity that we're finding is actually on the prepaid market. And, you know, we are making some adjustments to make sure that we remain competitive. It will take a couple of quarters for the green shoots in terms of what our team will be doing there to kind of restore market. So you're absolutely right. The prepaid market is at the moment actually quite competitive. And, yeah, I mean, I guess it's good for the customer at the same time. We just need to make sure that, you know, we remain price disciplined as MTN. We've got targets that we've communicated to our stakeholders about service revenue growth and margins we'll deliver, and we'll make sure that we deliver that, you know, over the near term.
You've you made some remarks recently about the impact of MVNOs on the market, and in fact, you issued a warning saying that there's a risk here that this could develop into something that actually starts to hurt network investment in South Africa. Do you want to maybe just expand on that a little bit? Do you think all the MVNOs are behaving rationally, or do you think some irrationality coming into the space now?
I think globally, where you see MVNOs operating in a way that the ecosystem, let's call it, is balanced, is that generally the MVNOs are small, relatively small groups that have a particular niche customer base that they're targeting, and then they're right on top of the digital infrastructure of a large you know, operators such as an MTN, whether you look in Europe or other places. But then you have many of these, you know, kind of relatively small MVNOs adding up to quite a bit, you know, maybe takes 4-5% market share, overall market share. I think that's what you normally find in a market where you have two or three players and you have MVNOs that sit on top of those. I think what's developing in South Africa is that the MVNOs are large. They're not small, and then and there is a risk of kind of distorting retail pricing because those MVNOs are not necessarily
profit-led.
Profit-led. Within the domains of connectivity, they make their money elsewhere. So they'll probably be able to subsidize data, as an example. But the cost of production of a gigabyte of data remains whatever it is. And, you know, when you start seeing pricing that's below the cost of production, it can distort the market. It can distort the retail market. So I think a market of comparison would be Netherlands. I think the Netherlands at some stage was a bit like that. A couple of my colleagues worked in the Netherlands market, or former colleagues, Jens Schotenbakken, who used to be our group COO. He kept reminding me that, you know, the MVNOs are necessary part of the overall landscape, but, you know, pricing dynamics, you know, can actually distort the market and damage the market actually in a material sense. So that's the only issue that we were raising around the potential to distort the market, particularly at the retail end, and mostly around on the prepaid market. So that these were the comments that we're making.
When you sign new MVNO deals, are you able to say to those MVNO partners that...
We can't say
you
that.
You can't, because that would be anti-competitive.
Yeah, that would be anti-competitive. So that we can't say.
Right.
We just...
So your hands are tied in some ways. I mean, it's really up to the MVNOs and how they decide they're going to price.
Yeah, look, I mean, but the MVNOs sit ultimately on operator networks. And, you know, there are contracts, and, you know, these contracts come up for renewal over time. So at the right point, we can, you know, look at the pricing for, you know, the wholesale market. Because we need to make a return on the cost of production.
So responding in the prepaid market to the competition you're seeing out there, is price your primary leverage? And and if it is, how do you avoid trashing your margins?
Yeah, price is not the only trigger. I mean, there's an investment that we need to make around distribution, sales and distribution, promoting ourselves. There are some regions where we're more competitive than others, and the reasons where we're not competitive, we've got to look at what we can become, what we need to do to become more competitive. There's a lot of promotional activity and investment that's ultimately required. We also need to look at... you know, the mix of what's above the line and below the line pricing. South Africa is quite a sophisticated CVM market, you know, personalized pricing. And how do we work around that, headline versus personalized? So there are a few levers to that we can pull. But as I said, we're going to be quite disciplined. We know we need to deliver margins of 35 to 37. Service revenue, want to be, you know, around inflation and a little bit above that. So we'll always seek to optimize to deliver those kind of results. So it's not all going to be about pricing.
Okay. You recently installed new leadership in South Africa. Ferdi Mulman, who used to run your Nigerian operation, and Bartle McCounts did a very good job of that. And Yolanda, is it Cuba or Cuba? Are running that business now. What's your brief to them, and what metrics are you watching most closely in that business?
No, look, I mean, these are two very strong individuals that we've appointed to, you know, take the South African business forward. I think the one thing is we want to be more commercially competitive. So particularly in the prepaid side, and we've spoken about that, sustain our, you know, the progress we're making on enterprise, the enterprise market. We're beginning to pick up, you know, good momentum, both in the private and the public sector. And then on the postpaid side, you know, there's some work to be done to improve and to simplify our offerings there. So there's one element that's really around the commercial excellence. The second is we're doing quite a bunch of work to kind of modernize in the offers that we take to our customers. So We have some work to be done around kind of modernizing our IT real estate, making the customer experience much slicker. I think customers of today really expect a very slick experience on how they get onboarded for new offers, upgrades, and so forth. So there's a bit of work around the modernization, IT modernization. The third bucket is really just to look at, you know, the structure of the leases that we have with tower companies, the debt that we have. So we can kind of, further strengthen the resilience of the balance sheet. And so those were the three big areas of priority: commercial excellence, IT modernization, as well as kind of look at the balance sheet, you know, can it be more optimal? Mm-hmm. We have leases with both IHS and ATC. What can be done there to improve that? You know, the debt that they have, you know, how do we manage? So there's a bit of that kind of balance sheet. But the main point is really around kind of the commercial excellence. And Yolanda will in particular look after, you know, the consumer and the enterprise businesses. Mm-hmm. So those, the executive teams will report into her for consumer and prepaid and postpaid and enterprise. Wholesale will report directly to Ferdy as the CEO, because obviously we need Chinese walls between the wholesale business with the retail business. So you can't have Yolanda having sight of what's on the other side of these Chinese walls. So the wholesale strategy, which, you know, talks to how we engage with MVNOs, that will report directly to Ferdy. So yeah, they have their marching orders, and we look forward to the impact that they're going to have in the next couple of quarters.
Just in terms of the size of the local market and the number of players in this space, you've gone on the record previously to say that the South African market, I'm going to quote you, needs to consolidate into about two mobile networks. Do you still have any interest in Telkom, or is that just a deal that's too hard to get over the line from a political and regulatory perspective? And if it is too difficult to get off the line, do you need to do a deal that would give you fiber assets, given that Telkom obviously has OpenServe and Vodacom has just concluded or is in the process of concluding the acquisition of a co-controlling stake in Maziv, which owns Vumatel?
No, look, I mean, I stand by the comments that South Africa needs, you know, consolidation. And actually, you need it to attract more investment. I mean, I know it sounds counterintuitive that, or could sound counterintuitive that fewer players creates the space for more investment than the other way around. And I think this is a global development. Let's start there.
Okay.
And, you know, India had 14 players 10 years ago. They got 2.5 players, let's call it that now. But they've been able to secure and attract more investment. And the operators there are putting a lot more of the free cash flow they generate back into investing in the digital infrastructure. So, I mean, let's call it three players. India has three players. China has three players. The US has three players. Mm-hmm. The UK is consolidating. Europe is consolidating. You see what Orange is doing in Spain. And you look in the Far East. So the consolidation theme is upon us. And I think it should be quite logical because, you know, data networks versus voice networks require a lot of investment. And I often say to my team that the CapEx we put in the ground feels like OpEx. It's the same number every year. $2 to $2.5 billion worth of CapEx is what we put into the ground every single year to do with capacity as well as increasing coverage. So there's significant requirements, we operate with CapEx intensity, sales to CapEx of 15 to 18%. So you're going to do that every year for some time to come to meet the demand. So the dynamics of data and digital infrastructure are such that, you know, to be frank, only large players can really sustain that level of investment. Not too different from what you see in mining. Mm-hmm. You have the mining majors, you have the oil majors. We're coming into the world where you have the tech majors because significant capital needs to be mobilized and for a very long sustained period. So that's my thesis on consolidation. And, you know, we stick by that. In the SA market, you're right, we tried to do, I think it's almost 3 years now, to do a deal with Telkom.
And it was your third, I think, attempt to do a deal with
Telkom. I've been told it's the third, that each one of my predecessors, except Rob Shooter, had a go at it. So yeah, you're right, it was the third attempt. I mean, these things are complex, eh, Duncan? Mm. And if you look at the Sprint T-Mobile deal, they also had three attempts. And they managed to get it, through a very narrow kind of regulatory and political window. As I read that case, one of the key things was, the motivation was, if America does not consolidate, they're going to lose the 5G race to China. And that became the biggest catalyst to say, let's get this thing, approved through all the states. You know, it's complex in the U.S. You need regulatory approval. So when these things come up, the window is generally very narrow when these market consolidate. And you need the conspiration of forces that come together. Number one, the kind of regulatory environment and the political environment would support it. The price and the kind of industrial logic of a deal needs to be agreed by two parties. And all of those three things, regulatory, kind of political perspectives and the commercial, financial rationale, all need to fit into that window. Mm-hmm. And then a deal can be done. But if they don't all come together, it's very tricky to get these things over the line because they're public interest sort of issues that you also need to resolve. You'd need to give back spectrum or a kind of market repair initiatives are needed. But the logic of, combination for us remains, appealing.
Mm-hmm. It's just the difficulty of getting it done.
Yeah, it's a question of, do these three things come together at the same time? And if they do, we would still, talk to Sarabi and his team and his board on the other side. I think we've never, that's a position that we've said publicly.
Yeah.
If these kind of three forces all came together, we would put it forward to our board and our shareholders.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe something in the future.
Maybe something in the future.
But nothing right now.
Nothing right now.
Nothing right now. Okay. And if a Telkom deal doesn't happen, do you need to buy fiber assets or are you comfortable with your position in the market?
Look, I mean, the way we think about fiber is, we need it for a variety of reasons. You need it for backhaul for your own network and making sure that your network is fully invested. Mm. But also the fiber story is about winning the home and winning the enterprises. In fact, you need to go beyond fiber and think about edge when you now talk about business. But let's just stay with the home opportunity. I mean, we think the home opportunity is going to be tackled ultimately the medium term by three technologies. Obviously, fiber is an important technology, and fiber is the most sure-proof way over the medium to longer term, to win there. It takes time to deploy. You've got to pass homes, then you've got to connect them, then you've got to keep the customer happy, very low churn.
Mm.
So that's the fiber story, which is, the kind of nirvana. If you didn't have to dig up and trench or put, roll out fiber, kind of overhead, and the difficulties that come with that and the payback periods, that's the only thing you would do. You just like put fiber. But there's also fixed wireless access, where we have sufficient spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You can tackle the home opportunity with fixed wireless. And then I think the more, nascent technology that's coming up is LEO.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the way we think about it is, winning the home is a key part of our strategy. And we're saying we'll attack it with both fiber and FWA.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll see what
depending on the geography and the density.
Depending on the geography, the density, the mm-hmm. customers. I mean, let's step outside of South Africa a little bit and go to Nigeria. So you go to Nigeria, I mean, there's very little fiber to the home.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that's an obvious opportunity to say, look, we won't let what happened to us in South Africa maybe 10, 15 years ago where maybe we should have been investing in fiber 15 years ago more aggressively than we have, particularly to the home. We have sufficient fiber for our own network,
sure,
but particularly to the home. So in Nigeria, if it's like an obvious case, Carl and team, we'll be putting fiber to let's say, Banana Island. There's there are these estates. You know, we know that the customers in these estates can afford mm-hmm. a home connection, the price that we can offer. But coming to South Africa, I think, you know, we're not going to be rolling out fiber in that way. It just doesn't make sense. There's a lot of fiber that's already in the ground, mm-hmm. And we would be kind of, you know, putting too much infrastructure that is unlikely to generate a return. So we would tackle the home with fixed wireless access, as we are doing now, and actually we're seeing, you know, good progress there. The only issue with fixed wireless access, very few homes can chew up a lot of your spectral assets.
Yes, exactly.
So you have to keep watching and balancing that.
You can't really offer uncapped.
Yeah, so you can't offer uncapped. Mm. It ultimately, you will have no spectrum for your mobility customer. Mm. So, I mean, we will look at, you know, balancing, you know, pushing fixed wireless access. And if we can't do the kind of bigger type transactions, as I said, they're very complex to get done and everything needs to line up. I mean, we'll see what we can do. Yeah. There are smaller fiber assets that are out there that we would, you know, we could look at in terms of building out the home. So, you know, often get asked the questions with our shareholders, which is, what are you going to do about fiber? Are you going to deploy it yourself? Are you going to buy? Are you going to partner? I said that deploy is not a strategy mm-hmm. In meaningful. So it will be a combination of the other two, whether we can partner or make some acquisitions over the medium term in South Africa.
Okay, so acquisition is very much part of the...
No, it's part of the mix. I mean, it's mm-hmm. I mean, the alternative would be for us to go and put the capex in, sorry, the fiber into ground. We don't think it's a sensible strategy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we move on from South Africa, I just wanted to come back to the topic of online betting, online gambling, and the impact that's having on the telecommunications sector. Obviously, it's having a far broader impact. Mm. But what is your take on? I mean, everywhere I drive now, I see billboards for online betting companies. It's obviously a booming sector. Mm. Do you think it needs to be better regulated than it is? Do you think that it's out of control? And is it having a serious impact on the telecommunications industry in terms of revenue right now?
Let me start with your latter question. Is it having an impact? And the answer is absolutely yes. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you think about the numbers, I don't know which numbers you've picked up, you know, in the reports that we've seen, it's like 75 billion rand of... you know, wallet spend is going towards online gambling. That's a lot. Mm. That's a lot. And it comes from everything that might be innocuous, like, you know, do you think the Springbok rugby team is going to beat Ireland? You know, what's your wager on the bet? You know, and what's the, you know, what's the gap between South Africa winning or losing? And it can look like it's just small stuff. But I think where it impacts, you know, very vulnerable people, I mean, it's obviously got to be a matter of concern. But it is impacting the industry, and I think this is wallet spend. Our customers, many of our customers have limited spend. So if they're betting, that's spend that they could have spent on telecommunications or other services. So it's impacting, I think, beyond telecommunications. It's probably impacting retail more generally. Mm-hmm. Your question is, you know, should it be more regulated? I think these things, you know, you've got to protect the vulnerable groups, which is young people. Mm-hmm. And I think you do need to find ways and mechanisms from a regulatory perspective, and also to protect, other forms of vulnerable groups beyond the young folks.
The elderly, too, blowing their pensions.
Yeah, exactly, mm. But the pensions, exactly. So it is something of concern, let's be frank, huh? Mm. Because there could be social ills that, you know, emanate, you know, from all of that. And the companies are profit-seeking. Now, you know, somebody the other day says, you know, do you tell people that they can't have a glass of beer if they wanted to? I guess, you know, these things are, you also just have to be careful of the lines where, how far you go. But there is a need to think through who are the vulnerable groups. Duncan, I don't think you're vulnerable, and neither am I. But, there is more that can be done to protect these vulnerable groups, you know, over time. As you say, I think you're absolutely right. Pensioners and the youth, the student who might, you know, be using his NFSAS allocation to gamble.
Yes, and that's happening apparently. Yeah, SASA grants.
Yeah, exactly. So so there are some social issues, and we need as a society to reflect a bit more deeply on that one.
All right, let's talk about LEO satellites.
Yep.
Project Kuiper, recently renamed as Amazon LEO.
Yeah.
Starlink, of course, is active in this market as well, desperately looking for a license, it seems, and not seemingly getting there.
Yeah.
What impact do you think LEO satellites are going to have on this market and on the markets in which you operate across the continent?
Mm.
Do you see these guys as partners or potential competitors?
I think they're going to be both. We're going to partner them and we'll compete. And actually, we're already doing that as MTN. But standing back a little bit, Duncan, I think one of the things is to say, you know, if you look 3 to 5 years out, as humans, we're always going to be connected, whether we're flying from place A to B on a long-haul flight, whether you go on large water bodies, you're deep in the ocean or in some forest, you will be always connected. That era of always connected, irrespective of where you are, is upon us.
I'm not sure I'm looking forward to that.
Exactly. It's got its downsides as well, because it's like Big Brother's watching you. Huh? Exactly. So we sometimes from
time to time.
I can't
get away from my email.
Yeah, you want to get away from your email, or you just want to kind of decamp from being connected. But I think what we're going to see is the LEO satellites are not going to go away. And they're going to become an integral part of connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
So you're either going to connect through mobile, fixed, or kind of LEO. And your device, whatever it might be, will just seamlessly be attaching to the network at that particular point, and do so in a way that you, as the individual or as the business, you know, you don't perceive that there's actually any change. So that's the world we are moving into, and we must embrace it rather than fight it. Now, specifically, you know, what are we doing as MTN? We recognize that we are going to collaborate and compete at the same time, the same organizations. So I'll give you an example in Nigeria. For backhaul and a few other markets, we are working with Starlink.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's new for us. It's a bit of an old story now. In Zambia, we're beginning to look at both partnering them, Starlink specifically, both in backhaul and direct-to-consumer. Because we've looked at Zambia and we've said, just looking at the topography of the country, the density of populations, and the alternative of us putting a lot of fixed infrastructure versus partnering, there are business cases where partnering makes sense. So we'll call the Starlink people and say, in Zambia, as we're doing now, let's partner D2C. So for us, LEO satellites, we see them as an integral part of the future, and we are embracing it. But we are being very selective on a market-by-market basis how we partner them.
Okay.
We don't have one kind of global partnership agreement with them. The agreement is always going to be local. Can we get the pricing right? Is there a minimum commit that we will need to sign up for the service, et cetera, et cetera? We're going market by market. So Nigeria has a engagements, ways of working with the satellite operators. Zambia would look at it differently, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see us partnering, you know, Starlink in Zambia, but, you know, could you find that we don't partner them direct to consumer in Ghana? For sure.
Mm-hmm.
There's no case for us to do that. But in Zambia, there is. So we are taking a market-by-market approach where we are going to partner and we understand that we'll compete. And today it's Starlink. Tomorrow, as you say, it's Amazon. And don't forget, you know, the Chinese and other nations are beginning to think about launching their own satellites into space. I think this is an area, Duncan, that where we're going to see sovereign-type issues coming into play very soon. You know, we're talking about sovereign data centers, sovereign AI, and all of that. I think very soon this topic will be a lot more common, and discussions about sovereignty and the security risks of information. Where does the information move to? Where is it stored? Do you have ground station and so forth? But it's not going away. It's our new lived reality, and we have to embrace it.
I mean, it must make your job a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it's a lot more difficult. But at the same time, you know, easier. I mean, like the backhaul story with satellites, like almost like a no-brainer.
Right.
You can get the commercials right. You know, it's a good form of backhaul, particularly in moving traffic from pretty remote sites.
Yeah, you're going to be able to put up base stations where they're just not feasible right now, right?
Exactly. So then you now have base stations in the sky. Mm-hmm. Basically, you got to think of it that way. I think in the South African instance, specifically to Starlink, you know, yep. What we've always said is same service, same rules. So we don't mind competition. And I guess this is also the position of the GSMA, which I sit on the board, is, you know, for the same service, let's have the same rules. So we are under certain regulatory tax. In South Africa, we have, we have our own kind of triple BEE requirements. So we're simply saying, just meet those, whether it's Starlink or Amazon or whoever it might be, it's okay. What we didn't really want was just a unfair playing field. Where there are rules that are different for, LEO satellite. It's a form of communication. So they need to be under the same strictures. And once that's done, it's easy.
So would you support the equity equivalence proposal as long as it applies fairly to everybody, equally to everybody?
Yeah, if it came to being, I'm not sure as MTN would ever take the equity equivalence approach, given the nature of who MTN is and what we stand for. But yes, it must be available to us. Mm-hmm. We can then choose that we're not going to implement an equity equivalence. We'll do a traditional triple B deal.
But you want that option available?
We want that option available. Mm-hmm. That's all we're saying. So if it's there, it can't be for a specific group. It must be available. And we want that option.
Yes.
I doubt we would ever be able to exercise it as MTN specifically because we have a history where we came from that goes all the way to 94 that I think would make certainly during my tenure here very difficult to say we've abandoned triple BEE and but we want the option.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Let's talk about your international markets. Mm. We've focused quite a bit on South Africa in this discussion so far, but let's have a look at Nigeria. Mm. In your latest quarterly numbers, it's doing very well. The business was hurting you for a long time, and now it's one of your best performers. What concrete milestones in MTN Nigeria would convince you that the country's risk return profile is truly fixed and that this is not just a temporary stabilization?
Yeah, Duncan, as we've been in Nigeria now for, I think now 2002 to now, so almost 23 years. I guess the way we always look at particularly the large markets is that, you need to take a structural long-term view.
Mm-hmm.
Are there going to be bumps in the way? For sure, there are going to be bumps in the way. But, if you look at a country like Nigeria, there's a deficit of digital infrastructure, there's a deficit of infrastructure. Big population basis, a well-educated population. We've taken the view that, through the cycle, an investment in Nigeria is going to yield returns that are materially above the cost of capital and the risk that you're taking. So we had a very tough 2023, 2024 with the sharp devaluation of the Naira. You go to 2023 when President Tinubu came in,
mm-hmm.
and he made these announcements around structural reforms, unification of exchange rates, removal of the subsidy, initiatives to deal with the theft of oil and trying to get production up and all of those. And the Naira was around 460. And then you went to June of 2023, 777. You finished the year at 907. And I remember in early 2024, I'd gone to visit one of our markets in Benin, and I was catching a flight actually from Cotonou in Benin to Lagos, which is a short hop.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said to me, "Ralph, have you looked at the Naira? It's at 1300. And I said, "What happened?" 1300. And I landed, it had lost another 100 Naira in a 30-minute flight. Yeah, and then your stomach works, and then you just got to stay composed when you see your staff, because they're looking to you for leadership, and so you can't look like you're panicking.
Panicked,
so you're just this calm, composed person. Yeah, and then we came out and we said, look, there are these five things that we are going to execute on. And if we sustain them, you know, we'll bring the business into repair. I made some remarks in 2023 that I said, you know, these structural reforms are going to be very painful for mm-hmm. some period of time. I guess I underestimated the severity of the pain.
Okay.
But the pain we saw coming for sure. Now, given where we are now, as you say, what has happened? I think the medicine taken to bring in the reforms that probably should have been taken over the last 30 years in Nigeria, I think we're seeing, if we think about the country as a patient, the patient is stabilizing. Mm-hmm. The Naira has been quite stable, 1,500 odd. Inflation has rapidly started to come down now, so it's now below 20%. It was shooting way into the 30s, like directionally going towards the 40s. The exchange, the reserves that the central bank in Nigeria has, these have been built up, so now talking, more 40 billion odd rather than the 20s. So they've been able to, build up reserves to, to support the currency and any trade. And there's a willing buyer, willing seller market. You can get dollars at the exchange rate that's available now. And we're seeing oil volumes improve. The Dangote refinery has come into place, which is also helping. That a lot more domestic refinery capacity will go up to a maximum of 600,000, it seems, and it's on its way there. So, Nigeria's come off the grey list like South Africa has.
Oh, has it? Okay.
It's come off the grey list as well.
Okay.
And, the IMF post these, World Bank meetings held a few weeks back. The story is very progressive on Nigeria. So that macro has helped us, including some tariff increases. We're able to have a 50% tariff increase to buoy and support the financial results you spoke about. So I think the Nigerian business is kind of back in growth. Mm-hmm. It will start contributing to the group in terms of dividends. The last 2 to 3 years, we haven't had dividends coming out of Nigeria. So it should change the shape of the business. So you can never say you're all-knowing about the future, Duncan, but I can say that, the country looks like it's in a stable condition and has been able to weather. And if there's a sustained momentum now towards driving economic growth and everything that President Tinubu said is implemented, I think we'll see Nigeria contribute more and more significantly to the group results.
Okay. It sounds like your key markets are actually doing all right. There seems to be a lot of currency stability at the moment.
Yeah.
South Africa's kind of doing all right.
Yeah.
Nigeria's on the mend. Ghana, I think, is doing quite well.
Yeah, Ghana as well. I mean, if you think about, I came into this year, particularly in the first quarter with a sense of, with all the noise around the trade tariffs, et cetera, that we're going to see at a macro level a lot of volatility.
Mm.
Actually, it's been relatively stable. And in fact, we've been surprised in Ghana with the strength of the cedi. The cedi was we went into the year like it was shooting towards 16 cedis to the dollar. And then by half year, it was all the way down to 10. The Ghanaian cedi at 30th of June was one of the best performing, if not the best performing market against the US dollar.
They got inflation under control.
Inflation, I mean, they've been boosted, let's be clear, by, the gold price and volume of gold sales.
Ah.
And Ghana is a big gold. And, as gold went to, $4,000 an ounce, and cocoa is another big export earner, and they've been
and cocoa price has also gone through the roof.
Cocoa price. So Ghana has benefited from that that kind of dynamic. Mm. So at a macro level, I mean, pretty much most of our markets, given everything that's happened in the year, the macro has been actually quite stable.
Mm.
Now, when I look at our reported results, Duncan, I've been here now, almost like 8 years now. Yeah, it feels like 20 years, but it's only 8 years. But if I look at our reported result on service revenue that we printed with Q3, it's our strongest reported result for service revenue, strongest by country distance.
Hmm?
Maybe it might even be our strongest reported result in a decade.
Wow!
In terms of the service revenue, so it's the macro has been conducive and supportive of kind of our own operational execution. And as you say, even in South Africa, I want my team to do better on prepaid. But the macro has been, you know, quite supportive. Mm. Inflation's coming down. Now you see South Africa's targeting 3% inflation. Oh, that's the direction of travel. So the macro has been, notwithstanding all the noise we hear, at the ground level, ground zero, actually has been a more accommodative than we had anticipated.
Okay, that's good, because the macro has been against you for a long time.
Exactly. So. Yeah. We have a slight tailwind, slight, let's call it slight. We're just used to having headwinds with them.
What about your smaller markets? I know you've exited a couple of operations in the last few years. Mm. Are you looking to exit any more? And what is the current status? What is the current situation with your investment in Iran?
Yeah, look, I mean, on the African continent, I think we've gotten pretty much out of the markets that we wanted to kind of, you know, get out of, in particular the Guineas. Look, we still have an aspiration to enter new markets where it makes sense. So this must not be seen as MTN is pruning its footprint on the African continent. Mm. In fact, we have an aspiration to be a bit stronger than we currently are in South and East Africa in particular. So when I look at the portfolio of the group, it's very lopsided to West Africa and South Africa. Mm-hmm. And we've got good businesses in a place like Uganda, Zambia, Rwanda. But, you know, we're not in Kenya, we're not in Tanzania, we're not in Ethiopia. So over the medium to longer term, to kind of balance, you know, the opportunity and the risk, I think you would see us over time. I'm not saying there's anything right now. Mm-hmm. But over time, I think where the opportunities come in, particularly Southeast Africa, mm-hmm. you know, East Africa's got very high quality growth, you know, with relatively lower risk profile, to be fair, with, say, West Africa more broadly.
Sure.
So this is an area that we would like to explore. And I say this, explore, and I use the word over the medium term, 3 to 5 years, rather than it's immediate. In terms of the Middle East, I think Duncan, we were super clear in 2020 that we announced a strategy of exiting the Middle East, and that would exit it in a phased manner.
Mm.
We'll start the first phase with the consolidated subsidiaries, and these being Yemen, Afghanistan, and Syria. And, you know, exits in these regions are very complex. Who's going to buy? At what price? How do you do the transactions? And, I mean, if you think about how we've exited the Middle East, we've basically given these businesses up for free.
Mm. We certainly did that in Syria.
Yeah, we certainly did that. I mean, Syria, we had to abandon the operation, although, you know, now Syria was under sanctions, now it's not under sanctions. Yemen was a dollar for the network, basically. And the process we got out of Afghanistan were de minimis. We just simply said, look, it's important for us to get out of these markets. You know, we have no advantage operating in the Middle East. We want to focus our attention all on Africa. So that was phase one. Phase two is Iran, the Iran investment. Now, sanctions were brought back in Iran in May 2018. I think the last cash repatriation, I was group CFO then, Rob Shooter was CEO, and I remember going to Tehran to engage the authorities for the last, I think it was $200 million we managed to repatriate. In February 2018, and that was the last we
last
ever got, yeah, we got anything out of Iran. And then the U.S. sanctions came in May, and we comply fully with the sanctions regime. We have a team in Dubai that's checking, you know, who's on the sanctions list, etc. Mm. So once the U.S. sanctions came in, beyond complying with the sanctions, it became difficult to start thinking about, so who's going to buy the asset? Or how do we exit Iran over time? And so in many respects, Iran is kind of like a frozen asset. We don't put any money in. We don't get any money out.
Are you a passive investor there?
I mean, we're a minority investor. We don't have control. Mm. You know, we're a 49% shareholder, so we have a voice, but we don't run and control the entity. But, you know, our clear strategy since 2020 was we would exit all of the Middle East. And if all of the Middle East is there, it means we will be exiting Iran. The geopolitical conditions have become quite complex around exactly how do you engineer that exit. Mm. Often people say, why don't you just, like, abandon the operation?
Yeah.
Now, that's easy to say, but legally, when you abandoned, you're still the beneficial owner of those shares.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually haven't done
anything. And you're sitting with a lot of cash there, I presume.
Look, I mean, the cash is there, but, you know, we're more framed by, you know, kind of compliance more generally around, you know, a very complex geopolitical environment. Mm. And so it's not as if, Duncan, we're sitting here and saying, listen, we're going to take risks that are beyond what we and our shareholders have appetite for.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a simple way of exiting the market in a way that was orderly, I mean, you know, that's the marching orders I have from our board. So it must never be seen as, you know, MTN as an entrenched position and is not moving, because the actual exit is actually very complex.
Mm.
So I'll give you an example. So if we decided to sell to party B, let's say they were in Tehran, how do we know that that party has got no sanctions kind of linkages? And then you have now, you know, been in a situation where you have created benefit for somebody who is, you know, is sanctioned, as an example. And then all of a sudden you're in trouble when you're trying to do good. So that whole space has been complex. And we spend a lot of time, you know, talking to the authorities, not only here in South Africa, but our shareholders based more broadly, and even in the U.S., around, you know, some of the complexities around having this stuck investment, call it, sometimes I use the word, you know, it's as if it's like frozen, no money in, no money out.
Mm. It's almost like a stranded asset, in a way.
In a way. So, yeah, but the geopolitical conditions are very complex, as you know, but we're trying to navigate them the best we can.
But if you can get out, you'll get out.
Yeah, if we can get out, we would get out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to turn to something I know you're very passionate about now, and that's artificial intelligence. I've read some articles and I think possibly listened to a podcast or two in the last few months where you've spoken about how you've been spending your evenings brushing up on what all these chatbots can do and the impact of AI. In fact, I've been doing the same for AI is going to have a very meaningful impact, and I'm not quite sure what it is yet on the media industry, but... But it's something you've been delving into a great amount of detail. First of all, why do you feel as Group CEO of MTN that this is something that you need to commit significant time to? And secondly, how do you see it transforming this industry?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's the so-called foundational technology that we're experiencing now. You know, somebody discovered that you could light a fire, the steam engine, the wheel. All of these things changed our lives, and this
is on the same sort of level.
The same scale. And I think there's a wonderful metaphor from there's an economist, I think he's at Oxford now, the name is going to escape me, but he says he thinks of it like electricity, that, you know, for those who have been using it, you become, you know, a lot more efficient, and there's going to be cases that we don't even know about its use, because those, you know, use cases are still to be developed and so forth. So it's a foundational technology that, even if we don't know precisely how it's going to change our lives, we know it's going to have, you know, a massive impact on productivity. Now there's some issues and concerns about power and climate change and so forth, but let's park those for now. It is going to be a transformational, foundational technology that changes the way we work, the way we live, and so forth. Now, significant investments are being made in building these large language models, building the data centers that do all the processing in places like Virginia in the United States and elsewhere across the globe.
It's actually staggering the amount of investment that's going there,
hundreds of billions. Now, my concern has been that, you know, as Africa, we can't be looking at this and say, we're watching a movie here, and we're not participating, is that trends and developments in the global north in particular, you know, could far outstrip what we're seeing in the global south where we live. And isn't there a risk that we become the digital underclass of the global north if we're not involved in some way with these, I mean... Google have now just launched, just as you and I were getting used to 2.5, now they launched
3.8
last week. And I was using it the other day and I could see the difference already. So my point is that AI has the ability to materially improve productivity in Africa. That's one thing. Secondly, I think it can be a great equalizer. Children or communities that are poorly served, you know, with resources, digital infrastructure services and AI can actually help, you know, poor communities. I always think education is one of the few levelers within a generation where somebody can come from poverty and, you know, to becoming meaningfully participating in the economy. And I think AI will play a role there. So it's this foundational technology. It will change things the way they we do. I mean, at MTN, my ask of my team is, how is it changing the way we work, number one? It's changed the way I work, to be clear. So my finance team is not always happy with some of the things I'm now saying because I've used AI to interrogate the data sets and I'm asking questions and I get the somebody asks me, but Ralph, you're asking this question, were you using? I say, yeah, I was using my AI tools. But on a more serious note, I think it will ultimately transform the way we work as a company and drive productivity gains. I think it will change the way we engage our customers and how we serve our customers. It will change the way we run our operations, particularly network operations. Now, if you think that AI can help you in being more intelligent in how you do your network planning, how you manage power, it could bring really meaningful, you know, savings over time. And in future, I think it's also going to be potentially not just about efficiency, it's going to be about new revenue streams over time. You're seeing people selling GPUs as a service and so forth. So I think we're at the early stages. The only issue I would raise, Duncan, is that I think there are some things that we need that to fully democratize AI will need. The way these large language modules are currently working, they're consuming a lot of data and kind of GPU resources. You know, in time, will we see the cost of these GPUs come down? Will we have a DeepSeek moment where you don't need large language modules, but these small language modules that require less power but are just as effective? I think that day is coming.
That operate on the edge, maybe on your base stations.
100%. They operate at the edge and actually on the radio network. AI RAN is a big topic that we are engaged in right now.
In fact, NVIDIA's CEO Jensen Huang did a presentation at GCC a couple of weeks ago just on that topic.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we're staying close to all of these developments because, you know, we've got lots of radio access network equipment that's out there. So I think it'll be, it's going to transform. So when I say, you know, I'm at night school, it's because you just don't know exactly. Right now, the use cases are not as obvious, but there'll be a tipping point, and you just don't want to be behind that tipping point when it happens, because it will change the whole industry, the ways of working, etc. So we're trying to stay close. You know, we're staying close to the hyperscalers who are partners with us in their own endeavors. Ultimately, we see a view where, you know, they're going to be AI grade data centers needed on the African continent. I don't think you're going to find it in every country, but in geographies such as South Africa, in Kenya, in Nigeria, in Egypt, and a few other locations, you know, significant investment is going to be built around AI data centers.
You've announced you're building one in Nigeria, I think.
Yeah, the Nigeria one, we've completed phase one. Okay. We're now going to the phase two.
How do you do this in power-constrained markets like Nigeria? I mean, the electricity situation is much worse there than it is in South Africa. And in fact, electricity is a problem across the continent. Yet these AI data centers consume vast quantities of electricity. It seems there's a bit of a dichotomy here. How do we resolve this?
Yeah. No, look, I mean, we're not building a 1 gigawatt data center.
You're not building Stargate.
We're not doing Stargate at all. I think we will be proportionate and in a way that can meet our market. So the power requirements are not as outrageous or, you know, as scale as we're hearing what's happening in the Middle East and elsewhere in the U.S. in particular. But we are kind of building fit for purpose. And if we sense the demand is there and we have the power, to your point, Nigeria's, you know, our network is largely off-grid in Nigeria. Diesel generators, we still get high levels of availability. So 99, The 9.5s we can hit in Nigeria with lots of diesel. But it's not environmentally friendly. So I think what you'll find, Duncan, in Africa is we're gonna build them in a way that is fit for the market. I think the big issue we're gonna find is sovereign. Sovereign AI is gonna become a big issue across markets. So we'll have to find constructs that can work economically in a country.
Mm-hmm.
Because in an ideal world like the cloud, and you can see the trend around information security and so forth, is ideally shouldn't really care where these data centers sit, but for obvious national security reasons and mm-hmm. other reasons, that does matter. Latency could be the other reason as well. So in Nigeria, as I said, we are building, and this is a 5-10 year story. I don't think it's an immediate story right now,
yeah.
but I think you'll see us, being. Investing, quantums of capital proportionate to the opportunity that we see around AI.
Do you see this being like the low Earth satellite space, where you both compete and cooperate with the big international players, the hyperscalers? Do you see them as a partner and competitor going forward?
I think in this space, we're not really competing with them, to be honest, Duncan. I think the capabilities that are required to build these large language models and as well as on the inference side, I think there's space for us to play. I think a partnership model is the one that makes most sense.
Mm-hmm.
We've just announced a partnership with Microsoft. We want to take M365 and Copilot to our customers more broadly, and we'll announce the detail early in the year. We want to roll out from February next year. But that's a form of partnerships. I mean, we don't have the capital and scale to compete with them directly. And I also believe that they don't have the ability to get to our customers as easily as we can. And so they find a natural partner in ourselves. So it's more with the hyperscalers in this space going to be more, working in partnership. Mm-hmm. We just said the scale of the investments are scary, $100 billion in the US alone. I mean, we spend $2 billion on CapEx annually as MTN. So we can't compete with them at scale, but we can partner with them at scale.
Yes.
In a similar way, like we're partnering them on, subsea cable. You're aware of the 2Africa cable that was lit, last week. That's a, we take capacity off that as MTN from Meta. And that's a partnership model. So I don't think you'll see us competing, but I think you'll see more partnership there.
Ralph Mopita is President and Group CEO of MTN. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much for chatting with the Tech Central audience today.
It's no, thank you to you, Duncan, and trust that your listeners found this discussion useful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.